The speaker we have tonight is someone I met a while back, and I was very impressed with him because he has a very non-traditional way of looking at mediation because his background is very different. It's not a lawyer background. So reading off the thing you probably got in the mail, he's the founder of Genesis Mediation. His name is Dr. Randall Kinnison, and he brings over 30 years of experience in mediation, coaching, counseling, and helping families cope with difficult life issues. Dr. Kinnison understands family and system dynamics and underlying root causes of conflict. He uses compassion and professional expertise to help families or businesses. And also, he works with elder and estate issues to add to that, which is what he's talking about tonight, to help them find common ground and form positive plans of action to move forward. Dr. Kinnison has led or established nonprofits for over 3 decades. He understands the dynamics between boards, management, staff, and customers, and I would ask also say with the estate and elder area as well. He teaches conflict management skills and inter-office communication. He assists in succession planning in sole proprietorship, family businesses, and partnerships. He has expertise in productivity, leadership, and building consensus. He also assists in forming of partnerships and family business as well as dissolutions. He works with small and mid-sized businesses, nonprofits, and corporations. The three areas he works in are in divorce work, mediation, also in business mediation, and in elder and estate mediation, the three areas. There is an office here in Vancouver. And so we're really very happy tonight to hear about a topic we don't hear about enough, especially from a non-attorney perspective. So this is Dr. Randall Kinnison. Thank you for coming here tonight.
You know, when you get to be an elder, you wear your contacts, you need your reading glasses, and if you don't wear your contacts and you take your glasses off, it's just one of those things, isn't it? So a little bit about my background. So the reason I had that experience is I was actually a pastor for 30 years. As a pastor, I learned a lot about elder care. I had a lot of elders in my congregations and found myself actually doing quite a bit of mediation between family members and issues, succession issues. Dad wanting to give the farm over to son, that didn't always go well. I got drafted in as a pastor to help settle issues. So about 9 years ago, when I decided I wanted to leave traditional ministry, I looked at what are some things I could do that could leverage all the information, my education as well. And mediation seemed to be a great fit. Realized I'd done quite a bit of it throughout the years. Actually went to Africa a couple times to help deal with some tribal disputes there, which was really fascinating. So I've been around mediation and been doing it actually for quite a few years until I actually started the firm. So now I've enjoyed doing elder care work most of my life, really. And so now I just kind of made it official. So I want to focus on what are some things in mediation that help you professionals, because I think we have attorneys here, we have some financial people. How does this relate to your world? I want to be very specific about some things, and I think there's some things here that can tell you about how somebody like myself can interface as a non-attorney mediator. So outside of that attorney world concept of mediation, this is how I'm going to speak to you tonight. So let's review just a little bit about what mediation is about and some key principles. So one, it's voluntary. There is such a thing as court-ordered mediation. To me, that's an oxymoron, if you ask me. It kind of violates the real principles of mediation. To me, mediation is voluntary. It's client-led. It's self-determined. It's confidential. I think one of the great elements of mediation is the confidentiality around it. In Oregon, they just passed a bill not too long ago, Adverse Health, where now many of the adverse health issues are going to be required to go through mediation. Statistics demonstrate that when a physician can apologize to their patient, the chances of malpractice go down tremendously of litigation. And in mediation, that can happen because it's a confidential, it's protected. So there's some things that can happen in mediation to me that are fascinating and creative and incredibly rewarding. It's non-binding, so this is something that a lot of my clients appreciate, is that when you think about many of the arbitration mediation clauses, my experience has been when people go through that route, it's about 10 to maybe 20% mediation, about 80% arbitration. And so they really don't get a feel for mediation. They get a feel for arbitration. And when you have a non-binding element of mediation, it helps clients kind of relax a little bit more, knowing that this is something they truly can determine. It's not going to just get brought up the ladder to arbitration. So clients themselves kind of behave differently in non-binding mediation than they would if arbitration was attached into that process. It's based under informed consent, and that's where many of you people come in mind. Our clients must have sufficient information in order to make logical and educated decisions. And so it's common for us as mediators, since we're not the attorney, we're going to send them out for legal counsel. We're going to send them out for financial counsel. It's not unusual in these kind of situations where I send somebody to a financial planner to help them determine whether it's a settlement from an estate or whether it's a settlement from a divorce. What does your future look like, and how can you make sure you can negotiate well in this process right now so that you can end up in the best possible place? And I'm doing that as a mediator for both clients, obviously not just one client. And so I use professional people on a regular basis. Well, most of you in this room would be people that I constantly refer my clients to because they need you. They need your expertise. Sometimes they need your guiding hand. I had one case where the woman was getting a settlement, and it was going to be about $800,000. So it's not large settlement, but it was going to be sufficient for her needs. But there was a lot of fear that kept her from negotiating because she was sure that that wasn't going to be sufficient. She was sure she was going to be destitute. And I actually, in this case, not only did I send her back to her financial advisor quite a few times, I actually had the financial advisor on the phone in the mediation just to help bring that informed consent into the room and help her kind of balance power, because she couldn't quite understand all the numbers. Her husband did. She didn't quite understand the numbers. So there is a very important role for all of you in this room when it comes to what the kind of mediation that we practice. So let's kind of talk about the different applications of it. So one is preventative uses of mediation. These are all in your notes if you want to follow along. I decided to go old school tonight. I think most people are kind of tired of PowerPoint. I know I am. So I could project what I'm going to read, but that doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me. So I figure you all can read tonight. So what are preventative uses of mediation? One is assisting in creating a will or a trust that mitigates conflict among family members. Sometimes we're brought in as that's being crafted, because there's conflict already within the crafting of that estate. And if you can craft an estate, if you can get the consent of the parents to work, understand their children, understand the dynamics of their family, and craft an estate that makes sense, it goes a long ways toward when that estate has to be executed by that successor trustee or a personal representative. To give you an example of one case where it was about a $2 million estate, had a business attached to it, a couple other things, and one of the daughters came to me and said, I need your assistant. I'm living in this one place, and I'd like to stay here. It's part of the estate, and my brother wants to sell it because he thinks everything should be just sold in the estate, and I'd really like to keep this part. And I said, well, okay, let's talk about it. And when I called brother up, who is the successor trustee, he said, well, what's there to talk about? Everything is just equally done. I said, well, yeah, everything is equally done, but just because it's equally done doesn't mean everyone's interests are being met, right? So when there's a lot of pieces in the puzzle, It's to me, it's fun as a mediator to think about those different pieces and how do the different pieces relate to each other, and how can we really help people walk away with the win-win in a situation where they're grieving and they've got other things that they need to deal with as a family, as opposed to fighting over an estate. And most of you in this room have seen some of the best of families seen the very worst side of them when it comes to settling estates. They're all smiling right now. You've seen that. To me, it's tragic. It's really tragic. And some families never get past it, right? They hurt their relationships so badly, and they burn the bridges completely behind them that there's no family left. And that's all they have. Their parents are gone now. That's all they have is siblings, and now they've scorched the earth around them with that. To me, it's extremely sad. I worked with a corporate family one time. I was called in under other circumstances, and it was a business dispute to begin with. We dealt with some of the business issues, and then we dealt with the estate issues because, thank you, the estate issues, let me give you a quick scenario. So the father and mom had, the estate was primarily the buildings that the business ran out of, okay? So the kids, dad decided to give the business to the kids. Kids were fighting among themselves over the business, okay? Got very ugly. I was brought in. One of the things that was helpful is we sat down with the estate attorney and we helped educate the kids as to what that estate really looked like. What was coming down the road for those kids? Now, I know some parents don't like to do that with their children. I fully understand that. But in this case, it was extremely helpful because the real wealth was coming from those buildings, probably $30 million in buildings that is coming down the pike as part of their inheritance. That was more than enough to take care of any of their needs that they would have. So here's the key. They didn't really need to fight over the business because what was coming down the pike was far greater. And once they learned that, then it was amazing how we could calm things down on the business front. Does that make sense? And there was a skip generation trust that was involved too that we had to clean up. But once we did those things, then everybody started playing a lot more nice. So it was helpful to bring the estate attorney into the process, even though that really wasn't critical to the business element of it. But here's the key to what I want to share is I went back to them and then said, and I offer this to all my business or estate people. I said, now do you want to go back and try and repair some of the damage you've done as families, right? And so we go back and we meet together as family and we talk about what does it mean to be family now. And we write a family covenant. How are we going to treat each other? Well, what do we expect of each other? Are we going to show up on holidays? Or are we going to blow each other off? If we're going to show up on holidays, how are we going to treat each other? And in this case, this corporate family, it was the first family gathering for Christmas. They celebrated 8 years. That was pretty cool. That's the kind of thing that gets me excited about being a mediator. It's not only being able to help bring peace to families who are warring, but to hopefully hold them together or maybe reconcile them. In our elder care and estate work, it's not unusual for us to help a dad or a mom reconcile to an estranged son or daughter before death. That's cool. That's powerful stuff that you can't put a price tag to. So one of the things we can do is we can assist in creating that will or that trust. And if you see a family fighting in front of you, or if you hear the mom and dad saying things like, man, I'm not sure what I think all hell's going to break loose once I die, that's a good clue to think about, hey, maybe we should consider bringing in a mediator to help us deal with some of these dynamics before death, because you can actually deal with some of these things before death, and it will clean up your work tremendously. I know most attorneys that I know don't like all the drama that can happen within this arena. You prefer not to deal with some of this drama. So there's some things that you can do to prevent that. It clarifies. The other thing it can do is just be clarifying a will or estate. One of the things that sometimes we end up with is it's not unusual for some families to have a disabled sibling or a sibling that acts like a disabled sibling. So there are times where there's been at least a son or daughter that they may even be living with mom or dad. I just married my 85-year-old father last weekend. I flew to Colorado to marry my 85-year-old father. I thought that was kind of cool. So we made sure we had a good prenup. And one of the things, so one of the dynamics that's happening with my own father is as his new wife, my new stepmom, has a daughter that lives with them. And she's not disabled, but she's probably never going to have a good paying job. And she will probably always be living with them. And she will probably evolve into a caretaking situation. And so my antenna are already up about how to make sure that's done well. How many times do you know families that kind of fall into caretaking, right? All of a sudden there's an incident that escalates the need for caregiving, and families look around and they don't really want to necessarily go to a facility yet, or maybe there's not the funds to go to a facility yet. And somebody raises their hand and says, I'll take care of mom or dad. And it's usually the one least equipped to do so. It's the one who's been on drugs. It's the one who's already gambled. It's the one who couldn't hold down the job, right? And now we're going to let them take care of mom and dad. What a great idea. And we're going to let them have money, access to the money. And then we wonder why we have abuse. And we wonder why we have problems. Even well-intentioned caregivers fall into this line where they're pointed that out of the goodness of their heart, they say, I'm gonna move in with mom or dad, or they're going to move in with me. But there isn't clarity among the siblings and the family as to, is that person going to get paid? And if so, how much? Whose car are they going to drive? Are they going to have a car to drive? What kind of respite are they going to get? And who will help pay for that? And then you get a family member who feels abused, who feels lonely, who feels isolated. And we wonder why they might abuse their parents, especially if they're dealing with dementia and the frustrations of trying to tell a mom or dad not to do that again when they can't not do that. Their brain, their capacity is basically that of a three-year-old. If you've seen the PET scans of those advanced with Alzheimer's, their brain capacity is literally that of a three-year-old, but they can't learn like a three-year-old any longer, can they? So you can't tell them what to do and expect them to retain it, because they literally cannot do that. Those channels in the brain are broken and they will not remend. They will not cross over again. They will not heal. And so we leave these family caregivers, and all of a sudden we wonder why the bank account gets drained a little bit, why they can feel entitled, why they do some of the things they do. And thank God for the millions out there that don't, right? So there are different ways. So one of the ways that we do get called in is when we see accusations of elder abuse. We've yet to have to actually report elder abuse, thank goodness. But we do hear a lot of rattling of the saber a little bit, you know. One of the case studies I have here is one that gives you an example of that. I just recently did a case with an attorney, a court-appointed attorney, to try and collect on Medicaid fraud. And when the gentleman thought he heard from the attorney, he just kind of clammed up and didn't respond, which was not a good thing to do. And so the attorney, good attorney, and was just trying to work with this gentleman and wanted to continue to just get, can we sit down and talk about this? Can you demonstrate to me, you know, where the funds went? And there wasn't neglect and there wasn't fraud. So finally she reached out to me, and so she asked me to intervene and could we mediate. And so I called the gentleman. It's amazing when a non-attorney person calls somebody else who's been engaged by attorney, they just tend to relax a little bit more. And not that you attorneys are bad people, but you know, I talked to the gentleman, I explained the situation, and I listened to a story, and I realized that there wasn't any intentional abuse happening here. There wasn't any intentional fraud. And so I got him prepared to meet with the attorney. We sat down, and within 2 hours, we cleared up the whole thing, and we were done. To me, that was satisfying because one is the state collected funds that they needed to around pieces that they needed to, but the other gentleman was no longer fearful of a call from an attorney and realizing and that he was actually doing good work with the estate, but he just wasn't transparent enough with the people he needed to be transparent with. So there's, I've alluded to this a little bit before too, but one of the things we help with as well is family mediations, just for the sake of families. And we've actually spun off a separate company called Genesis Life Transitions because the word mediation kind of jumped out at people and says, oh, I don't need a mediator. You know, they thought somebody was headed to court or something. And so we call them family conflict coaches. You know, we use all the skills of mediation, and my people have usually counseling degrees and as well as they're fully trained mediators. But they come alongside and basically help families reconcile, and they help coach families when there is a need to move to a facility or there's a need to increase home health care, whatever it is. But the families are conflicted, they feel frozen, they don't know what to do. And oftentimes that daughter has worked many, taken mom or dad around to facilities, finally picked one out, ready to move mom to a facility, and then out of town brother calls and say, how dare you? That's never happened to any of you, by the way. And so we bring, you know, brother. Typically, older brother is older brother, and he's usually personal representative or successor trustee. And so we bring him into the picture and talk about what needs to be talked about and try and get people on the same page. Now, here's another interesting thing that's happening now, and I predict will be worse going forward. I'm dealing with an estate mediation. People are walking in the room, introducing themselves, and we're ready to sit down. And one of the daughters comes up to me and says, Dr. Kennison, I just want to let you know, I don't know about anybody else, but it's not about the money for me. what did she just tell me? It's all about the money, right? Now here's the thing that I find happening is we have 10,000 baby boomers retiring every day, depending on which financial piece you look at, anywhere from about around, what term I've heard is 25K in their 401K, which is not very much to go around, right? So the dynamic is when you're getting families together and you're talking about needing to move mom or dad to a facility, everyone in this room knows how much it costs to move to a facility, right, and how quickly it can drain an estate. So what happens is one of the siblings inevitably, who doesn't have much retirement, who's looking to mom and dad for their retirement, they'll say, on my dead body, do we move mom or dad to the facility? And they want to couch it that it's all about, we're going to keep them at home no matter what it takes, and they say all the right things, but if you lift up the sheets and look underneath it, what's really happening is they're very concerned about their own well-being going forward, because what they were hoping for to help their, to get this inheritance to help them in their retirement is going to be gone by taking them to a facility. That's a very real dynamic, and it's only going to increase. So that's an issue we face, and when we get families on the same, you know, when you're trying to get families on the same page, we have to deal with those dynamics. We have to be able to talk to that son or daughter and help them understand what's really in the best interest of mom or dad, and that may be going to facility, that may be staying at home, but as mediators, we try and make sure it's in the best interest of mom or dad, right? And as long as mom and dad have capacity, they darn well better be self-determined, right? So So those are things that that we deal with as well. Those are some of the most rewarding situations, actually, is when we help families that are in conflict get the same page, rally around their loved one, and help them through that process. One of the other, so how does a mediator like me work? What does it look like? Well, when usually somebody has to call, start the process. When we give a 15-minute free phone consultation to help families just try and figure it out, you'd be surprised how many people we help even in a phone consultation in 30 minutes. We've helped a lot of people just in a 30-minute consultation around how to proceed and what to do and how to refer them to other people. But we determine whether or not the case is a good case for mediation. We determine whether, is this a family conflict coaching kind of a case where we can not use the word mediation and we're going to come in kind of more under the radar, or is this really a case that needs to be in mediation, or is this a case that really needs to be in litigation? So the first thing we need to do is determine what kind of case it is and how to proceed. And if it's in litigation, we just immediately refer them out to different attorneys that we know and trust. And to me, that's partly why you're in a room like this, is to get to know other professionals who you know and trust, right? That's what I've appreciated through networks like this. And so then we, from that, then we go forward. We start contacting family members. First of all, we got to decide who's going to pay. That's always helpful to know who's going to foot the bill. And once we determine that, then a contract is written. We don't do retainers, so a contract is written, and we go through our services agreement and decide on the pathway. And if it's a parents, oftentimes we'll sit at the parents' home and we'll talk to the parents in their parents' home. We usually like to see what's going on with the parents. We want to see them in their home. We want to kind of look around and see what's happening there and see if the kids are saying certain things about the capacities of mom and dad. We have a chance to look around and kind of affirm that and make our own observations. We talk to parents alone, away from the children, obviously, to determine what their wishes really are, making sure kids aren't putting their wishes in their parents' mouth. And then we proceed with trying to contact the other family members, and can we draw them together to see if we can get this done, whether it's a state issue or whether it's a kind of a coaching issue of trying to get them to the next level of care, whatever that might be. So that's kind of how we proceed. And you can ask me questions in a few minutes. So let me just kind of talk specifically about a couple of different cases that I have in the... And I can do some more case studies for you as well to give you some ideas about different ways to use mediation. So before I launch into this, one of the things that you might want to think about, one of the best times to call somebody like myself is before you need to call the attorney. We're best used before attorneys get involved in the case. Now that's not a slight at all to you attorneys in the room. It's just saying that if we can keep it from going to litigation, that's a great place to try and use this. I firmly believe there's a need in place for litigation. There's times where conservatorships and guardianships need to be put through the process. There's certain times estates need to be litigated because of the situations at hand within the family members. Some family members you're just not going to mediate with. It's just the reality. People with extreme personality disorders are not good candidates for mediation. So they're not even good candidates for litigation either, I'm sure. But you get them anyway, the attorneys. So one of my first case studies is called The Lonely Mother. So this was actually my very first elder care case when I first launched out. This was a group that all happened to go to the same church. All the family went to the same, this little country church. And so the pastor was the one who called me and said, please help me, I've got this whole family blowing up. And so what happened was, and I've changed some of the ages and the names and all this kind of thing, but a 94-year-old mom, cusp of capacity, still had capacity, but starting to really wane. One son who's a former meth addict, and what he was an ex-con. He had drunk. He had when he was drunk, he ran over somebody and committed manslaughter. And so because of that record, he was never really employable. At least that's to his account. So he was available. Remember that available thing I said? So the other siblings were all busy living their own lives. So let's let him take care of mom, right? So they let George start taking care of mom. And then one of the older son, who is the personal representative, Joe in this case, every now and then he would go into the bank account just to check and make sure, like I do that with my mom now, I'm on her bank account. Every now and then I just go in and check and see how mom's doing, making sure there's not any withdrawals that are weird or anything. And so he was just doing his due diligence and checking in with mom and wondering how the bank account was doing. And he noticed there was a $10,000 withdrawal from savings. That's usually pretty easy to pick up. And then not only that, but then he saw an ACH withdrawal toward a credit union toward a loan. of, figured it was an auto loan because he came in as Joe had a, George had a new car. And so that kind of perked his interest quite a bit. So he started digging more and found a few other things. So it began with Joe giving allegations of elder abuse, probably rightly so, obviously, in this case, against George. So then Sister came in, and Sister came in also to the picture, and she was kind of on the outs with Joe and thought Joe had overreacted, and got DHS involved, Department of Human Services in Oregon. And so they were looking at protective services, and they were starting to investigate the case. She thought he was being a little too aggressive. She thought she should have sat down and talked with George first, instead of just immediately going that route. So she was pretty ticked off. And so as she was ticked off, then she alleged elder abuse cases on Joe. So now there's George and Joe with potential elder abuse cases. And then Joe got mad and then alleged elder abuse cases against Sister. So now all three of the kids have alleged elder abuse charges against them, and all had restraining orders against them. So they had to bring somebody in to help Mom because nobody could go see Mom anymore. And poor Mom was wondering why my kids aren't coming to see me anymore. And so you get an idea. It was a pretty good mess. So the attorney who was attached to Mom called me, he knew me, and said, "Randy, can you help us?" And I said, "Well, okay, sure, let's give it a try." And so I interviewed all parties, and one of the things that's really helpful is just to have somebody listen. You notice that? And as a mediator, one of the greatest gifts we give is just a great listening ear. Just somebody who will listen, who's impartial, that is outside, that I can tell my story. There's a very powerful piece to that. It's so powerful that in mediation, when we usually start with opening statements, most of the time if you're in a mediation and you have opening statements, it's all about the position, right? And it's usually very positional. We help coach our clients to have an opening statement that tries to make it personal. In other words, because of this dispute, this is what I'm personally going through, and this is the effect it's had on my life. And by the way, and this is the piece of it that I believe I own that I need to apologize to you for. Now, that doesn't happen all the time, but I tell you what, when it happens, when you can help both clients or sometimes multiple clients come and they're each willing to apologize for whatever their part in this thing is, and they own it, and it seems genuine, that's the other key, but actually seems genuine, right? And they tell their story, right? This is how this has affected me. And they're not talking not so much about dollars and cents, they're talking about their own journey through this conflict. All of us, it's not unusual if you have an apology and someone else is willing to forgive somebody. You'd be surprised how quickly you resolve disputes when that happens. I'll guarantee you in the legal model, I've never seen that happen. Because the legal model is typically all about position. It's all about dollars and cents. And you actually want to typically take the personal story out of it. I find it's incredibly powerful to include the personal story, especially when this is family. So to me, I find that an incredibly helpful piece in the mediation process. And when that happens, it's amazing how quickly you go downhill from there and get resolution. Anyway, in this particular case, we had to bring everybody together in the attorney's office, and I did all my casework ahead of time. I listened to everybody's stories, understood quite a bit of the dynamics. And one of the things I often find is, and whether it's a state, whether it's anything in elder care, when you're dealing with families, you're dealing with family dynamics. And not all siblings are the same, and the parents don't parent the same. Even though they want to parent the same, each kid is different. I've got five kids, and I'll tell you, each one of them is different. We tried to raise them all the same. They're all individuals. I can't do a thing about it. And what happens in families is that, let's say you have four kids, four siblings in this case, and the real issue is with two of them. Maybe it's brother and sister. Maybe it's sister and sister. But that's where most of the dynamic of the conflict is around. And too oftentimes, in mediation, you would throw those people in a room without proper preparation. And what you have is the mediator then is doing nothing but trying to settle the dispute of those two people, and the other two kids are looking on. Because that's what they've done their whole life. And they're going, this doesn't work, because this is just like what we have at home. So if you can, by doing your case development, if you can discern where the vortex of conflict is at, and in one case where is another elder abuse case where two of these kids were alleging elder abuse to each other, one was in Mexico, so we had to Skype them in. At the end of that mediation, this was the vortex of the real issue between these other four siblings. We resolved that piece. They realized that these were accusations, that they both love mom, and they apologized to each other, and it went as well as could be expected. And so then when we brought the family together and we brought the other siblings together with mom, now the dynamics were far different, because we resolved, at least we'd made a good, very good start at resolving those issues between brother and sister. And then that work became very productive work, because that piece was already done. Does that make sense? And too oftentimes we throw people in a room, or we keep them caucused, and so none of those dynamics are typically addressed, and we wonder why we come to impasse. We wonder why we can't resolve the conflict. And until you understand the dynamics of the conflict and know how to address the particular parties in that conflict, you're not going to find resolution. It's going to evade you. And I don't have magic, but our rate is about 90% of resolution rate. That's a fairly high rate. And I think that's because we work so hard at trying to understand the dynamics of the conflict and working with the clients to reach a sustainable agreement so that it will carry on past the mediation. So in this case, we got everybody together, and after we'd done the case development work, and we worked out all the things that needed to be worked out around the will and around the thing. So the attorney was happy, everyone in the room was happy, and we were able to go forward with a plan that made sense for mom and for each of the siblings. So one of the things that I think is critically important that we focus on, and any mediator you use should focus on, is not only just helping you deal with the issue at hand, but can we help mitigate conflict going forward with your clients? What can we do to keep them out of conflict so that they're not just back here again? Because I call us conflict firefighters. We run in the buildings that are burning when everyone else is running out. Most people are conflict averse. You know, we're running in there and we're putting out the fire, but you know what we find is there's still glowing embers and there's lots of combustible material very close nearby. And that's why we reference to other professionals, because we're not caseworkers, we're not the financial people, we're not the attorneys. There are legal documents yet to be drafted and changed or put up. There are financial concerns that need to be addressed. There are caseworkers that need to be maybe brought in to help with this. There's all kinds of other people that probably need to be brought into the situation to keep them out of conflict going forward. And to me, that's one of the things we work hard at, is trying to bring sustainability to our agreements. Because it's one thing to wear people down in a mediation so that they can sign a dotted line, say you're done. It's a whole nother thing to craft an agreement that will hold up over time, even to the next morning, so they don't go home and have pillow talk with their spouse and everything unravels the next day. So the other one I looked at was the trust that turned difficult. So this is the one that, this is a similar case to the one I mentioned earlier, where when I called the person, the successor trustee said, "Oh, we don't need to talk. The trust is very clear. Everybody gets their equal half." I said, "Well, that may be true, but there's a lot of moving parts here." So, like, one of the things was the kids. They all had a beach house. Now they had a beach house. The beach house was originally bought for $10,000 from great grandpa, I think. You know, at prime real estate on the coast, right? Now it's worth $1 million. Okay, so how do you buy out somebody with that kind of money? There's not quite enough. There was a decent sized estate, but not quite enough to make it around for that. So then you have this dream vacation home that the family has used, lots of memories, and now it becomes a nightmare. And this is not alone. Some of you have dealt with these issues, right? The vacation home, that the dream that became a nightmare. And so what do you, you know, the family wants to keep it, but there's, like in this case, two of the families lived out of state. They weren't going to come back and use that vacation home, maybe once a year. And they were going to be on the hook. Not only is their $250,000 investment going to be wrapped up in this, but they're going to have to pay for it. They have taxes on it. They have taxes on $1 million property in Oregon aren't cheap. So there's taxes on it. It's right on the beach, so maintenance is huge. They were going to pay about $30,000 to $40,000 a year together as kids to have this property to retain it within the family. Well, that's about $10,000 each. So that week of vacation to come to the Oregon coast was now going to cost you $10,000. You can go to a lot of other places for $10,000 for that week. Hawaii comes to my mind. And you don't have to wear sweatshirts there. So, like, what are they going to do? You know, if this went to litigation, it'd be simple. The judge just orders it to go to sale, right? More than likely. So beyond some of the other dynamics that were worked out, this was one of the major ones. They decided that they're going to keep it for 2 years, give brother an option to see if he can financially afford it. He was the one that bought in with the trucking company with dad. He's the one with the most means probably to pull it off. He's the one who lived locally that used it and wanted to keep it. So they said, okay, we're going to keep it 2 years together. Well, we'll defer our $250,000 for right now to keep it as together as a family. We'll try for the next 2 years to actually try and have a family reunion there. And then after 2 years, if we can't pull it off, then we'll go ahead and sell it and we'll be at peace with it, knowing that at least we had 2 more years together to celebrate this property that we have so many memories around. You know, that's kind of creative stuff, isn't it? That's stuff that usually doesn't come out of litigation. And to me, that's the fun of mediation, is the creativity that can be expressed in mediation and helping families determine what could this look like that could be the best thing for you as a family. You know more than the state of Washington about what's in the best interest of your family. So why don't you keep the ball in your park and make your decisions as opposed to letting others make it for you? And to me, that's the beauty of mediation. That's the cool stuff that I get a chance to do. And so in this, they didn't invite me to their last one. I was kind of bummed about that. And I don't know. I lost track of this case. I don't know if what happened, whether the brother was able to buy it out or not. But the idea that they would come together and have at least 2 more gatherings on that property as family, knowing that this is something now that they're okay with, and they can just come and be family together instead of be like this, right? To me, was a gift. And those are gifts a lot of our clients need and they want, and they want to try and stay family. They prefer not to fight if they can find a way around it. At least some families. Some families actually like to fight, but most of them don't. So I don't know how long I've been talking, but probably long enough. So questions? Yes.
Do you have a specific process that you go through as you enter mediation? I mean, are there steps like introduction, discovery? Is there a procedural process that you follow?
Yes. So I now teach other mediators and do train them in the 40-hour basic training, and the process is fairly basic, but I've added a few nuances from what I've learned through the years. And I think one of the key things that differentiate my mediation as opposed to some other mediation trainings you would have out there is one of the first things I do from the very beginning, even when the client first calls me, is I say, "What's your highest hope? What you know, if you had a magic, wand, what would you do?" I want to try and give people the power to determine if you had the power yourself to make this case go away. What would it look like? And by doing that, what I'm trying to do is actually set the highest common denominator, right? So if, let me give you a quick illustration. Can you two ladies come up here for just a second? I promise I won't make you disappear or anything. I don't have any embarrassing pictures or anything. So let's say these two are at ends, right? So you'd be turned like this way, you'd be turned this way. Your arms are crossed, right? Saying, okay, there's no way I'm talking to them. I'm not talking to my sister. No way, no how, right? Okay. So they're acting the part pretty well, looks like. Okay. So let's say a lot of times I'll have a rope here and when I'm teaching. So let's say as a mediator, I'm calling. There we go. We'll have a scarf. Improvision. I love it. Okay. So hold on to that really tight. Okay. So say as a mediator, what I want to do is call them to the highest potential common denominator, right? So let's say they're arguing over mom's health. What are we going to do with mom? Is one of us going to caregive? We're going to put her in facility. Do we ramp up home health care? What are we going to do? And one says, no, she needs to go to facility. The other one says, no, I'm going to take care of mom. Okay. Fairly common scenario, right? So what do you think is the highest common denominator between these two?
Take care of mom
at the facility.
Yeah. Right. So actually, I'm pretty sure both of these love their mom and want the best for their mom, right? So if I can pull on this common denominator, I'm eventually going to pull them around. She's really stubborn. But if I keep pulling, you know, eventually I turn them around, and now they have to look at each other, right? And now we can have a dialogue. So to me as a mediator, this is what I call putting them on the playing field. They're not in the bleachers anymore. They're down on the playing field. Now we can probably work something out where we can find a common denominator that works for both of you, and more importantly, works for mom. Okay, thank you very much. Here, give a hand to your... So the process, I begin with that, and then the other thing that probably distinguishes some of my training is what I talked about earlier, is really coaching people for that opening statement, in the sense of helping them draw out what their personal issues are, were around their personal story, and can I help them own a piece of this? I use this saying quite a bit: own what you need to own and no more. Right? Some people own too much; they take on the guilt, they take on the shame, they take on too much. Right? Some people deflect everything away; they don't own anything. Right? And if you can help each party to own even something, right? Just something. I often hear the words: "This is the first time I've heard an apology out of that person." The other thing is sometimes I need to help teach people how to apologize because they suck at apology. Right? You know what I'm saying? Like, I forgive you, but you made me do it.
Conditional forgiveness.
Right? How many times have you heard something like that? And so if you can, I found that if I can help coach people to enter into the process well, the outcome becomes much easier. Not always, but you have a much higher sense of probability when you do that. So, but then you're going down the rest of the steps of now we're agenda building, right? And now from agenda building, we're moving into brainstorming. From brainstorming, we're moving into negotiations. And from negotiations, we're coming into resolution. And then we have the final write-up, that's a smart agreement. So that's kind of the process. Yes?
Is your mediation binding or non-binding, or is there a written result of this?
So the mediation itself is typically non-binding, and there is usually always some kind of written result. Here's what I do that is, most of the time I do not like to have people sign something at the end of mediation. And the reason I don't, I like people to go home and sit on it. I like them to go home and reflect on it. I want them to talk to their attorney, obviously, if they have an attorney. I even want them to talk to their spouse, because here's what I mean, because I need it to be sustainable. If all it takes is for them to talk to somebody and they come back and they want to change everything, I haven't done my work yet. And there's so many times when early on when I began my practice that I didn't get that part. And now that I let people sit on it, I know that scares attorneys to death at times to let them do that, but if I let them sit on it, I'll guarantee you we'll answer another question or we'll do something, and the end result is a lot more peace, that they feel good about their decision, and it's usually sustainable. It's going to last. Yes?
Would
What's your biggest failure?
My biggest failure? Okay, I'll go back to this first case. I could list several for you. I believe you learn by failing. So this very first case I talked to you about, there was a sibling brother that I didn't bring into mediation because all the siblings said, oh, he's just out doing, he's just kind of the quiet brother. He's never, you know, this is all about us. He didn't get into any of the drama, didn't enter anything else. And guess who blew that? Guess who blew it up?
It was the
same. Yep. Yeah, we were able to rectify it yet, but I didn't anticipate that. And now I try to, like in the case of like in trust issues, will issues, if in mediation, I like to actually bring in the in-laws. I want the siblings, I want your spouses in the discussion, because I'll tell you what, an in-law can blow things up wide open. More so, the kids can get along fine. It's somebody's wife or husband that can blow up the whole process. I would rather have them inside the tent than outside the tent. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Do you work at all with husbands and wives and new wealth, for example, husband or wife inheriting a large sum of money, and the other spouse feeling put out, and the natural tension that occurs, and do you work at all with the attorney in trying to design what's a proper estate plan?
We've done some of that. And here's a typical one is dad divorces mom, goes out and gets a trophy wife that's the same age as the siblings, and doesn't have a prenup. Wow, is that a disaster waiting to happen? You know, or sometimes they've come to me to help negotiate the prenup because wife is saying, if you really love me, you won't have a prenup. Right? This is real world, right? So yeah, that's yeah. And there's times, inheritance, in fact, I just had a case right now that inheritance is putting a lot of pressure on the marriage. All of a sudden, this new money came in. Where it used to be all our money, now it's my money and your money. Yeah, and it's putting a lot of pressure on the marriage because of it. Yeah. Yes?
So I think when I talked to you a while back, maybe I misunderstood the term, but it's more of an interest-based.
Yes.
Mediation rather than a position based. So the
Absolutely.
Interests of the individual are brought forward and discussed and looked at.
Correct.
So that everybody knows what's on the table rather than a position. Because in
Very
a position,
so.
You tend to stick more to a position like Velcro than
yeah,
you do
right.
to
think,
an interest.
Yeah, think Uri Fisher getting to yes, getting past no.
Yeah, yeah.
And I practice as well as teach interest based mediation. Yeah.
Would you say that, from your experience, that attorneys tend to do interest-based, or is it more legal-based, position-based?
Most of the I love training
it's
attorneys. I love
it's
training attorneys, by the way, because what I teach is so counterintuitive to what you've been taught as attorneys in positional-based mediation and negotiation. That the most attorneys get scared to death even of putting people in the same room. You know, they're used to keeping them caucused in a shuttle diplomacy kind of a negotiation-based tact of mediation. And what I find is that it's interesting. I have two people that just moved into my office suite, and they're both attorneys, and I think they're called Resolutions Center or something. But what they're doing is they're taking cases that have blown up with attorneys to the point where the clients have finally said enough is enough. And they fired their attorneys, and they're looking for some way to get resolution. And what they're doing is they're taking on those cases. And one of the attorneys made a very interesting comment that I don't usually often hear from an attorney. He says, it's all personal. Mm. It's all personal. And sometimes we forget that. So whether it's I'm the VP at Microsoft and I'm signing this contract, it's not just business, because that reflects back on me. It reflects back on my how good I am in my job and my professionalism, my competencies, all that. You know, everything actually is personal. We tend to forget that. We'd like to try and keep it impersonal, but we're human beings, and we do make it. You know, say it's not personal; it's business. Yeah, I don't buy it. It's I know very few people who sit with me who don't feel some personal element of injustice or some personal element of slight or whatever. It has become personal.
Kind of psychological. It sounds a little psychological.
Yeah, well, and that's my forte. So, so I like to think I'm behavioral based, but not touchy feely. Yes.
So when you say you have a 90% success rate, how do you define success?
By coming to resolution and not staying at impasse, so that we've actually got agreement, but among parties.
How many meetings do you usually have to reach?
To reach that? It's really interesting. In elder care in estate, it can be as simple from anywhere from 1 to 3 sessions of about two hours in length. That's provided you've done proper case development with the parties. And so in case development, I'm asking them to write me a narrative around three different questions. And then I usually have a 30-minute to an hour interview with each party before we get into mediation. And if I've done my homework well and I've prepared my clients well, then it's not unusual to actually reach resolution within the first two-hour session, depending on the complexities of the case. Yes?
How do you charge for your services?
We charge for business mediation, we charge $200 an hour. For more typical family and estate type things, $160. And if it's just family coaching, it's $100 an hour. So we lowered that price quite a bit because it didn't fit right, and we didn't feel like we needed to charge that either. And no one was going to court. It didn't take as much prep work and other pieces. So, yes.
Have you never seen a situation where adult protective services should have been involved and was not?
Oh yeah. We probably all have those cases, right?
That's why I was surprised when you were saying you've never had to report to adult.
Yeah, we've just been fortunate. I think part of that is the nature of mediation is, you think about it, it's self-determined, right? So people are self-selecting themselves to come to mediation. Typically, those cases, I think, get escalated to an attorney rather quickly, or they call social protective services quickly themselves. So a lot of times what we find in mediation is just family members have gotten really mad at each other and started throwing accusations around. I think that's why we haven't actually seen too many actual cases of it. Most of the time, it's I'm gonna make life uncomfortable for you, and this is a way I can do that.
Yeah. You have multiple parties, say 4 or 5 different parties, but you've got 1 or 2 that don't want to cooperate. How much effort do you make to get them involved in the mediation before you just? They all have to cooperate.
Yep. So now getting people to the table is a whole other skill set as opposed to just mediation. So getting those people to the table is a very, very important piece. And sometimes you get them to the table, you help them look at their BATNA, their best alternative to negotiate agreement. And so if their BATNA is litigation and you start looking at, so you send them to an attorney to get a consultation and, okay, here's the costs. Here's your opportunity of possibly winning. I love good attorneys who really paint the picture well for the clients and help them have a good understanding of what they're getting into if they go down that road. And also, if it's family, the fallout of that litigation is typically destroying relationships among the family because you that's just the process. It can be so hard within the family relationship. So. If you help families look at that, the people that are maybe dragging their feet, if you help them get a good, again, it's informed consent. If you give them enough information about what the alternative might be, that sometimes brings them to the table. Sometimes it's a matter of you need to build enough rapport with them. They don't know who you are and who are you calling. Why would I trust you? It's building rapport with them and helping to feel like you can be a trusted, neutral person in this process. I've had people say no and then have a chance to talk to them more and just get them telling their story. And then at the end of it, say, these are important pieces for your family. Isn't there some way, somehow, we could try and work on some of these things to help you sleep better at night?
So that means you have a lot of one-on-one discussion possibly with these people that are reluctant to get involved.
Yep. And those are all protected conversations as soon as you pick up the phone, right, with those. So they're all caucus protected confidential conversations. Okay. You're all starting to eat, so that's a pretty good clue that maybe I'm probably about that. So anything else before?
Thank you, Dr. Kinnison, and I always give a little gift as a thank you for coming here tonight.
Oh, thank you.
So thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And hopefully we'll be able to use your services.
Thank you.
Thank you.